In 1927, the world's greatest scientists assembled in Belgium to thrash out some of the most fundamental problems in physics.
Archive footage.
29 showed up, 17 of whom would become Nobel Prize winners, but one of their number could trump them all. Someone who'd bagged 2 Nobel Prizes in 2 different sciences. In a man's world, a woman had broken through. Madame Marie Curie. This is the story of Marie Curie's life, the adventures of a woman who refused to conform to the social mores of her time. A woman who could pop in on presidents and holidayed with Einstein. Who once trod the boards on Broadway.
Archive war footage.
Ran mobile X-ray units at the front as the French battled the Hun. Who even had duels fought over her. And wonderfully, for such a fiercely private woman, we've been left a unique view of her inner struggles in life and love. Because in the decades that followed her death, her family released her most intimate letters.
I'm impatient to see you, much more than I am uneasy about the difficulties to come. It will be good to hear your voice again and see your dear eyes. Until Saturday, my darling, I will not stop thinking of you.
The letters reveal the real Marie, a woman full of passion, an obsessive genius whose life was beset by tragedy and scandal.
BBC, The Genius of Marie Curie, the woman who lit up the world. A passing view of isolated houses, shrouded in a blue and pink dawn haze.
In every great life, there's a moment that comes to define you. A moment of crisis that forces you to dig deep and establish who you truly are. For Marie Curie, that moment came in the autumn of 1911, some 5 years after the tragic death of her husband, Pierre Curie.
A photo.
She was at the world's first international meeting of physicists and chemists, an historic invitation-only event, which would become known as the Solvay Conference. And she was happy. Perhaps because she had just received a telegram confirming she had won a second Nobel Prize. Or perhaps because she was there with her lover.
Professor Julie Desjardins.
Paul Langevin, he was a physicist, and at some point he was actually a student of Pierre Curie's. And he had worked with the Curies. I mean, you know, certainly both of them knew him. And he was a physicist of renown. Everyone knew who he was.
Most of what we know of their affair comes from the letters that Marie wrote to Paul.
The instinct which led us to each other was very powerful. I believe that we could derive everything from it. Good work in common, a good solid friendship, courage for life, and even beautiful children of love in the most beautiful meaning of the word.
Dr. Patricia Farah, Clare College, Cambridge.
Jeanne Langevin, Paul's wife, understandably was rather jealous and unhappy about this. She was a very intense, rather violent woman.
According to a witness, Madame Langevin accosted Marie in the street, where she threatened to kill her if she didn't leave France. Marie implored Paul to end the marriage.
When I know you are with her, my nights are atrocious. I can't sleep. I wake up with a sensation of fever, and I can't work.
Marie's downfall came when pictures were published of Paul and her at the Solvay conference. Enraged, Madame Langevin decided to act.
One day, when she was sure that Paul Langevin wasn't there, she somehow managed to persuade someone to break into the apartment where this person found a cache of very intimate love letters between Marie Curie and Paul Langevin. Marie came back from her conference to discover that parts of the letters had been published in the press. This has suddenly become a very, very public affair.
A photo of Marie in close-up. then a newspaper story in Le Petit Journal.
The press ran a series of scurrilous claims against her.
L'Action Française wrote, "This foreign woman who pushes a hesitant father of a family to destroy his home applies her scientist's subtlety by which one can torture this simple wife."
This venomous publicity stirred up an angry mob who surrounded her home and threw stones at the windows.
A plaque on the property's gatepost indicating that Marie Curie lived there.
The whole affair spiraled into a farcical nightmare.
For Langevin, the final straw came when he read an article in a newspaper accusing him of hiding behind a Polish woman's skirts. And for him, that was such an insult to his French dignity that he challenged the editor of the paper to a duel.
Sepia footage of duelists being handed their weapons.
They met at exactly 11 o'clock in the morning. They paced out 25 yards. They raised their pistols at each other, and the editor reported afterwards that he looked at Langevin and he thought, "I can't possibly kill this man. He's one of France's greatest scientists." So he pointed his pistol to the ground. So then there was Langevin, and he thought, "I can't possibly shoot this man. He's not pointing a gun at me." So he put his gun down as well. And that was the end of the duel between them.
Paul Langevin returned to his wife with honour restored and reputation intact. Marie fared less well. Publicly humiliated, she'd lost her companion, and the controversy meant she couldn't continue the scientific work that had brought her so much happiness. She fled into hiding with her daughters and entered a deep depression. The story of how Marie Curie ascended to become the world's most famous female scientist, how she lost it all, and subsequently achieved redemption, is one of the greatest sagas in the history of science. And it starts not in Paris, but 1,000 miles away to the east.
Warsaw, Poland. Snow blankets the city, and icicles hang like fangs from a lantern.
Marie Curie was born in obscurity, in a different country, and under a completely different name.
This is the Museum of Maria Skłodowska-Curie. In 1867, on 7th of November, it was the place where Maria Skłodowska was born.
From the beginning, Maria, as she'd been christened, had to face prejudice every day.
Maria Skłodowska was born when Poland was divided by three countries, Russia, Prussia and Austria. And in that time, Warsaw was occupied by Russians. It was forbidden to talk in Polish, to learn Polish history, to make Polish science.
Indeed, ever since Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo in 1815, Warsaw had been under the rule of Tsarist Russia. The occupier set about a cultural cleansing, banning Polish folk songs and dancing.
Twin spires beyond a line of leafless trees.
Russian became the state language.
An old photo of five children.
So it was in private that her father, Professor Vladislav Skłodowski, sparked her passion for science. At home, he kept a cabinet full of scientific apparatus that fascinated the young Maria, who by the age of four was already a confident reader. Later the same year, her mother began to lose weight and would cough constantly, a sign that tuberculosis was taking hold.
And of course, doctors said, you know, you have to stay clear of your daughter. And so she didn't have a lot of physical affection from her mother.
Her mother finally succumbed to the disease in 1878, when Maria was just 12 years old.
For many years, we all felt weighing on us the loss of the one who had been the soul of the house.
So for most of her formative years, her father raised her, as best he could, as a poorly paid teacher. She adored him, and it was from him that she inherited her questioning nature and her lifelong love of science.
People dancing to a folk band.
Maria left school aged 15 with a gold medal for topping her year. But Warsaw University was closed to women, so she was forced to give up her passion for science. She abandoned her studies and left to join her relatives in the country.
Bathed in a warm orange light, the dancing couples promenade and swirl each other round. Reading from a letter.
We do everything that comes to our minds. Sometimes we sleep at night, sometimes during the day. We dance, and in all we frolic so much that sometimes we might deserve to be locked up in a mental home.
The dancers are dressed in simple rustic clothes.
For most girls of her age, finding a good husband was the next step. But she and her older sister Bronya would break the convention.
Bravo!
They concocted an audacious plan that would allow them both to get a university education.
Delicate stalks glistening with frost.
Maria would remain in the Polish countryside to seek work as a governess. She would support Bronya as she left to study medicine at the Sorbonne University in Paris. In return, Bronya would later help Maria to join her there. And so it was that in the winter of 1886, Maria arrived at the family home of a wealthy beetroot farmer, the ruins of which still stand on land owned by Teresa Kaczorowska. Almost at once, Maria felt at home.
She used to go for long walks. She also rode horses. She knew the whole area. She would build houses of snow with the children, skate on the lake, and go for sleigh rides. She loved the countryside, but not in the autumn, because there was only beetroot, beetroot, and beetroot. Dressed in an elegant black coat and white fur hat, Teresa enters the windowless house and says, in the beginning, she was befriended by the Holzerowski family. They treated her like their daughter.
Maria taught the Żurawski children upstairs in her little room. And it was here that one day, she met their eldest brother, a meeting that threatened to derail all her plans.
Kazimierz Żurawski was a mathematics student at Warsaw University. He was 1 year her senior, very handsome and an excellent match. Maria liked this room because of the view. I think she also used to meet Kazimierz here. Unfortunately, Kazimierz's parents did not think a poor governess was a good match for their son. But Kazimierz could not stand up to his parents. He was afraid of losing his inheritance. So he gave up his love for Maria.
The rejection of the Żurawski family sent her into a depression that saw her abandon all thoughts of leaving Poland.
I have been stupid. I am stupid. And I shall remain stupid all the days of my life. I dreamed of Paris as of redemption, but the hope of going there left me a long time ago.
An imposing white building.
Heartbroken, Maria returned to her aging father in Warsaw, and here she may have remained in obscurity if it wasn't for what went on in this building, the Museum of Industry and Agriculture. Because behind its impressive facade was a secret Polish laboratory.
This is a very important place in Maria's scientific life. When she was about 18, 19 years old, she started to learn here chemical analysis.
The lab was part of the so-called Flying University, which moved from location to location around Warsaw to avoid the suspicion of the Russians. Here, all Poles could advance their education, be they male or female.
I try to reproduce various experiments described in treatises on physics and chemistry. From time to time, a little unhoped-for success would encourage me, and at others, I sank into despair. But, on the whole, I discovered my taste for experimental research during these first trials.
The pinprick headlights of an approaching vehicle in the pink and lilac half-light of dawn over a flat winter landscape.
Maria had rediscovered her appetite for science. She wrote to Bronya.
If my coming is just possible, tell me. And tell me what entrance examinations I must pass. And what is the latest date at which I can register as a student. I am so nervous at the prospect of my departure that I can't speak of anything else.
A mural of a woman holding lab flasks.
Bronya could at last repay her little sister as Maria prepared to give herself to physics.
The Eiffel Tower looming over a sun-dappled Seine.
At the close of the 19th century, the study of physics was a backwater. In the universities of Europe, it was widely accepted that all the important laws of nature had been discovered. Theories of electromagnetism, thermodynamics, and mechanics seemed to explain everything.
Dancing fingers of white and electric blue energy, then a Paris street scene.
No one could foresee that there was a scientific revolution looming. Even less, that one of its leaders would be a poor young woman from Poland who had just enrolled in the physics faculty.
Leave your home.
A photo of a serious-looking Marie wearing a smart striped blouse, superimposed over light dancing on dark water.
Live alone.
In the spring of 1891, Maria Sklodowska arrived in Paris. She found herself in France at a time when there was some ill feeling towards foreigners. So to better fit in, she changed her name to the more Gallic-sounding Marie. Her university, the Sorbonne, was one of the few elite European academic institutions that admitted women. In Britain, it would be the 1920s before Oxford and Cambridge allowed women degrees. She excelled, graduating first out of her entire year in science. But life was hard. After paying rent for her tiny garret room, she had very little left over for food or fun. If she was to stay in Paris, she needed a job.
She worked on magnets, which now might not sound a terribly exciting subject, but you need magnets when you're making electric motors and dynamos, and this was when the electricity industry was just beginning to take off.
Electricity companies were hungry to improve the quality of the magnets in their generators and thereby produce more electricity to keep the lights on. Marie was hired to help.
She carried out lots of very precise research on exactly what alloys you use to make a very powerful, very permanent magnet.
Now she needed a lab in which to work. And thanks to some shrewd matchmaking from a fellow Pole, she was about to meet lab owner and expert in magnetism, Pierre Curie.
A photo of the bearded Pierre.
When I came in, Pierre Curie was standing in the window. He seemed very young to me, though he was age 35. I was struck by the expression of his clear gaze and by a slight appearance of carelessness in his lofty stature.
30 years later, she remembered that very first moment that she saw him across the room and she was terribly struck, so I guess it was love at first sight.
She moved into the corridor of Pierre's lab at École de Physique et Chimie and set to work. Here, an extraordinary romance unfolded.
He caught the habit of speaking to me of his dream of an existence consecrated entirely to scientific research, and asked me to share that life.
Marie had her doubts. She was homesick and missed her father. But Pierre pleaded with her to stay and make a life with him in France.
Actors playing the parts of Marie and Pierre, who is quoted as saying, "It would be a fine thing to pass our lives near each other, hypnotized by our scientific dream."
I'm the only one to do what's to be done.
So where should I put this?
Oh, in the cupboard there.
In desperation, he insisted that if she left, he would throw in his career and follow her to Poland. He won Marie over.
It is a sorrow to me to have to stay forever in Paris, but what am I to do? Fate has made us deeply attached to each other, and we cannot endure the idea of separating.
Marie and Pierre were married on the 26th of July, 1895.
And Marie look blissfully happy as they take walks and bicycle rides together through verdant countryside.
They honeymooned on two wheels during the so-called golden age of bicycles.
A black and white photo of the newlyweds posing beside their bicycles.
On the newly invented pneumatic tyre, they rode far and wide across the French countryside.
Now, a photo of them arm in arm.
A year and a half later, still working hard on magnetism, Marie found herself bearing her first child.
She approached her pregnancy rather like a modern woman. She went on working right until the very end, whereas most women of that period, after a couple of months, they would have completely retired from public view and they'd have spent a lot of time resting and lying down.
In due course, Pierre's father, Dr. Eugene Curie, delivered Marie's healthy 6-pound baby girl, whom she named Irene.
She really didn't want her pregnancy to hinder her work at all, and she was the sort of woman who was sort of back at the lab bench within a couple of days of the baby being born.
Indeed, just weeks after the birth, Marie published her first scientific paper. It was an important work, which quickly spread around the world, standardising the manufacturing process of magnets. But soon after, she abandoned all work on magnetism, because she'd heard of a stunning new discovery, one that would be the making of her as a professional scientist. It was now 1896, and another Paris-based physicist, Henri Becquerel, was exploring the properties of uranium. Finishing work early one day, he placed his materials away in a desk drawer, leaving a nugget of uranium on top of a sealed photographic plate. When he opened the drawer the following day and examined the plate, he saw that it appeared to have been exposed to a bright light.
Holding the plate to a candle.
Serendipity had led Becquerel to the discovery that uranium was emitting unknown rays that could pass through solid matter.
Nobody had any idea what it was. It was not seen as a particularly fruitful research topic, which is probably why she, as a Polish woman, was enabled to pick it up, because there wasn't a lot of competition for it.
But after publishing, Becquerel promptly gave up on the strange new rays, leaving the field clear for the Curies. But how to measure these invisible rays? Marie needed something more sensitive than a crude photographic plate. Fortunately, she'd married a brilliant electrical engineer, and he designed a way of accurately measuring the strength of any potential source of these rays.
So this instrument is called ionization chamber. As Marie Curie did, we just have to put our sample between the two metal plates.
The new rays would then ionize the air between the plates, and a small electrical current would flow to another instrument, called an electrometer. This measured exactly how much current was produced.
The electricity will be transmitted and it will reach this instrument, which is called electrometer. And then, using the piezoelectrical quartz invented by Pierre Curie, it was possible to measure very precisely the rays emitted by the sample.
Renaud Huyn, Musée Curie, Paris.
Marie undertook the enormous task of measuring all the metals, minerals, and compounds she could get her hands on to see if any others were producing these invisible rays. And around this time, she started to refer to the phenomenon she was seeking as radioactivity. She'd given a whole new area of physics its name.
A reconstructed scene shows Marie testing a sample in her lab, then an actual photo of her performing the same operation.
But Marie's growing obsession with radioactivity came at a price. Irene and later her second daughter, Eve, were cared for by others.
Her father-in-law took care of her daughters, and that opened things up entirely for her. He was a widower at that stage, and, I mean, literally, there were whole years when he was their caretaker. But there are little suggestions of the daughters being resentful. And I say this because there were letters. Certainly Irene would write letters and she would say, you know, when are you going to come home? When are you going to, you know, be able to read to me instead of grandfather reading to me?
In time, Irene would understand Marie's passion for science. But Eve never would. And her resentment would remain throughout her life.
A reconstruction shows Marie stirring a large bubbling pot of grey-brown liquid, then working in the lab.
Marie continued to work at Pierre's apparatus until one day, whilst testing a substance called pitchblende, she got a result that sent the electrometer off the scale. This was the highest reading anyone had seen, and since it was so much stronger than uranium, it must be coming from an entirely new element. The question was, what was it?
Professor Andrea Sella wears protective glasses as he crushes material using a pestle and mortar.
Since pitchblende was a mixture of different elements jumbled together, somehow she had to free her new element from the compound material.
In Marie Curie's notebooks, I mean, she talks about starting with 100 grams of material. We're losing bits all over the place. You know, it's really substantial amounts of rock. And this is really hardcore physical labor. You've just got to pound and grind until you've got a nice, fine, free-flowing material. And at that point, you can move really from the engineering into the chemistry. The next step is going to be to actually try and dissolve it up. And she would have chosen nitric acid because what she would have known was that this could dissolve up pretty well any metallic ion.
A Bunsen burner.
At this point, Marie Curie would really have been reaching a kind of branching point in that there would have been the immediate question of where is the radioactivity? Is it actually soluble in the acid or is it left behind?
A quick check with the electrometer and she deduced correctly that her new element was in the liquid. But there was a problem. The pitch blend only contained a tiny quantity of this new element.
No, I can't get enough of that stuff.
So to isolate it, she'd have to process tons of the stuff to find her needle in a haystack.
And I've tried and I've tried.
Marie stirs a large vat of liquid over a wood fire.
We're standing in the car park of what's now called the ESPCI, which is a big physics and chemistry institute in Paris. And behind me here, there's a white line on the ground, and that marks out one corner of a shed that Pierre and Marie Curie were given to work in.
Do you think?
While Pierre works inside the shed, Marie carries another vat of liquid out to the fire in the yard.
The shed was run down, drafty and freezing cold in the winter, stifling hot under the glass in the summer.
And this was where all the horse carts of pitchblende would line up and deposit all their deliveries for Pierre and Marie Curie to refine.
When you think about the kind of lab operations that she was doing, I mean, a lot of it was really kind of repetitive, tedious drudgery. And in a way, you wonder what kept her going. And it's when you start looking at the notebooks that maybe one gets a kind of clue. And here on the 27th of June, 1898, she starts with 180 grams of powdered pitchblende. But at the end of half a page of description, suddenly, there she is, very large letters saying 300 times more active than uranium. There was always, in a sense, this sort of little light at the end of the tunnel, which was getting brighter and brighter.
For 4 years, she persevered, gradually getting closer to isolating her new element. And as she continued to concentrate the material, something wonderful unfolded.
Before they started all the experimenting, Pierre had said to Marie, "I wonder what sort of colour our new product is going to be." And he fantasized that it would be some sort of bluey, greeny magic color. And that was indeed what happened. As the pitch blend became more and more concentrated as they went on purifying it, this sort of strange, eerie blue-green glow could be seen all over the walls of the little shed that they were working in.
The interior walls of the wooden shed cast in a luminous green glow, then a nugget of material radiating the same eerie light in the darkness.
And they used to come here at night and watch it and marvel at it. And they had a family at home, but for them there was a scientific child that they'd worked on together for so long and dreamt about it. And finally here they were producing it in this tiny dilapidated shed with a glass roof.
And then you get to page 66 with a big underlined heading, which says dosage, determination, the 28th of March, 1902. And she says 0.1179 grams. And then there's a quick calculation. And at the end of it, in really large letters, there's Ra equals 225.9. She now knows the atomic mass, and she really knows exactly where in the periodic table this fits. This is kind of the moment of triumph. It's the culmination of years of work. She's arrived.
Congratulations.
After 4 years of bone-crushingly hard work, Marie and Pierre had discovered a new element, radium.
A rack of test tubes and tiny dishes of green powder on a workbench.
Its highly radioactive nature and eerie green glow set the world alight.
The Statue of Liberty and an American street parade, then a variety of products featuring radium as an ingredient, black boot polish, a drinking solution, radium bromide tablets, and radium water.
I think nowadays we're terribly aware of how dangerous radiation of any kind can be. But when it first appeared, it seemed like this new miracle source of energy. It was a universal panacea, and it was being advertised for throat medicines and cough cures, and you could buy radium toothpaste. And it was the sort of new hope for the future.
As the radium craze spread, some could still not believe the central role Marie had played in the discovery.
There's this marvellous caricature that came out in Vanity Fair, and there's Marie Curie and Pierre Curie in Man of the Year. And he's there and he's holding up this great big test tube, and the radium is shining out onto his forehead, and so his forehead is glowing with genius. And she's this little diminutive figure behind him with her hand on his shoulder, sort of peering over him, and you can almost hear her saying, "Oh, Pierre, you're so clever." You know? And so all the glory of the discovery is being attributed to him, even though it was very much a collaborative piece of work.
A periodic table.
The years of toil had paid off. In 1903, the Nobel Committee decided to honour the discoverers of radioactivity. But in a blatant show of sexism, the committee only nominated Henri Becquerel and Pierre Marie was ignored. Pierre responded that if this nomination was serious, he could not accept the prize unless Madame Curie's name was included. The committee was forced to relent, and all three shared the 1903 Nobel Prize for Physics.
We have been awarded half of the Nobel Prize. We are inundated with letters and visits by journalists and photographers. And yesterday, an American wrote asking permission to name a racehorse after me.
The Curies were on their way to scientific stardom, but their health was beginning to suffer from the years of exposure to radiation.
We can no longer dream of the great work days of times gone by. I can only keep up by avoiding all physical fatigue, and my wife is in the same condition. Pierre Curie.
Pierre was feeling especially unwell as he left Marie on the 19th of April 1906 for a series of appointments in Paris.
Crossing a wide Parisian street.
Pierre Curie's just had his lunch. He's in a hurry. He's got to get to the printers down there. It was raining. He had an umbrella. And he crossed the road. He slipped onto the cobbles. And he saw these two horses in front of him. And he grabbed the harness and tried to save himself. But then he got thrown down on the ground. And for a moment, it seemed as if everything was fine. The carriage missed him. But then just at the last moment, the back wheels of the carriage swerved and they went right over his head. And it crushed his skull and he died immediately.
A letter written by Marie Curie.
I put my head against the coffin and in great distress, I spoke to you. I told you that I loved you. And that I had always loved you with all my heart.
Marie Curie, on that day in April, became not only a widow, but at the same time a pitiful and incurably lonely woman, Eve Curie. The love-struck couple in a black and white film scene, then a photo of the widowed Marie wearing black.
Slowly, Marie emerged from her pain. 7 months after his death, she took on Pierre's professorship at the Sorbonne, supported by her closest friends. One of whom, Paul Langevin, had been Pierre's student. He too was unhappy, trapped in a loveless marriage, so it was perhaps only natural that the two became close.
So we're standing near the Sorbonne, somewhere in the area. Paul Langevin rented a small apartment and he used to meet Marie Curie there, and this is where they conducted their affair and where their love relationship blossomed.
They were together when Marie's name was put forward for a second Nobel Prize in chemistry in recognition of her work isolating radium and a second new element, polonium. To this day, she is the only person to win two Nobel Prizes in two different sciences. And so it was that she found herself sharing the wonderful news with Paul at the Solvay conference. She'd made it to the top table of physics.
A photo of conference attendees around a table, some seated, others standing behind.
But her union with Paul was doomed. Although in an extraordinary twist, this would not be the last Curie-Langevin relationship. Because two generations later, Marie's granddaughter married Paul's grandson. And to this day, her grandmother's affair remains a raw subject.
It was a big problem. There was all the campaign on the newspaper. It was not only the Polish woman, but the woman taking the husband in a family with four children and so on and so on. And there was a publication of letters.
Dr. Hélène Langevin-Julliot.
When his wife disclosed these supposed love letters, we think they were real, but we don't know all the details.
My feeling is that really they were falsified. But nobody took care of this point.
She was a widow, so she was not married, so she was not an adulteress in any way. The problem is, for her, this affair showed that she was a sexual being. And the reason why that was so damning for her in ways it would not have been for a man was because it showed that her science was not nearly as saintly as everyone had made it to look. Because, of course, a woman's sexuality and her science were somehow seen as one and the same. I mean, you know, when Einstein had his affairs, no one looked at what he was doing in his private life and what he was doing in his science life as related in any way.
Whether the letters were fake or not, the effect was devastating. For the French tabloids, the story of a famous female immigrant ruining the marriage of a prestigious Frenchman perfectly suited their nationalistic agenda. She was vilified, hounded, and abandoned by many of her previous supporters.
It was a very difficult period for all the family, and the children in particular.
Somehow, Marie had to find the strength to carry on. The turning point came when the Nobel Committee once again questioned her suitability for the prize in chemistry.
If the Academy had believed the letters might be authentic, it would not, in all probability, have given you the prize. Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences.
Incredulous, Marie rediscovered the inner steel that had got her so far. She wrote back,
I believe there is no connection between my scientific work and the facts of private life. I cannot accept the idea, in principle, that the appreciation of the value of scientific work should be influenced by libel and slander.
A harder, prouder, more aggressive Madame Curie emerged, who in her address to the Nobel Prize ceremony firmly established her ownership of the field of radioactivity.
The discoveries of radium and polonium were made by Pierre Curie in collaboration with me. The chemical work aimed at isolating radium was carried out especially by me.
A photo of Marie in her lab.
With this newfound determination, she set about rebuilding her life. And though she would never find love again, she would see her reputation shift once more as she took on an almost legendary status.
A bust of Marie in the small garden square of a large building. Benches are set beside trees, the trunks of which bear photos of her.
Marie decided to take charge of her own destiny. Rather than work in someone else's lab, she would build her own. She designed her Radium Institute to be a state-of-the-art laboratory built around a charming little square where she could indulge her love of gardening. Here she planted many of the trees and roses that grow to this day. But her peace did not last, because on the 3rd of August, 1914,
battlefield footage,
Germany declared war on France. Fearful of a German invasion of Paris, many fled the capital. Marie, however, stayed. Though all work on her new institute stopped.
A soldier carries an injured comrade over his shoulders.
As the war began to bite, Marie learned that lives were being lost because the entire French army had only one X-ray station.
The inside of a field hospital.
So in a moment of organizational brilliance, she conceived the idea of mobile X-ray units, small cars adapted to carry their own generator and lightweight X-ray equipment. To help the war effort, Marie taught herself to drive and took the so-called Petite Curies to wherever they were needed, where she'd unload the equipment, hook up the generator, and activate the X-ray machine with little or no protection from the rays for herself. But she desperately needed more technicians, so she brought her elder daughter to the front. In the 17-year-old Irene, Marie Marie had found a new collaborator. A relationship that would last until her death.
A photo of mother and daughter inside one of the mobile units.
By the end of the Great War, in 1918, Marie's X-ray units had treated over 1 million wounded soldiers. And with the subsequent Treaty of Versailles, Poland was given its independence after 123 years of occupation. Marie had lived to see her mother country free at last.
A life-sized photo of Marie at a window shows her appearing to lean on the balcony.
The French government never formally recognized her efforts during the war, but social attitudes towards Marie did begin to soften.
An old-fashioned laboratory.
She returned to the Radium Institute, where she continued her radioactivity research here in her laboratory. Marie had never taken out patents on any of her discoveries, so money was a constant worry, and she was running short of her precious radium. That's why in 1920, perhaps sensing an opportunity, she agreed to meet one Missy Mattingly Maloney, an American journalist who had come all the way to Paris to interview her.
Over the course of the interview, she comes to discover that Madame Curie, who had discovered radium, did not actually have a gram of it to run her experiment. So Maloney decides, well, I'm going to start this big radium campaign in the United States. And she's the perfect person to do this because, of course, she's very well connected. And indeed, she comes back to the United States, and within months, she raises well over the $100,000 she needs for this gram of radium.
An ocean liner.
And so on the 11th of May, 1921, Marie arrived in New York's Hudson Bay to collect more radium. It was still incredibly rare, and if she was to ensure her institute's future, she needed more. Accompanied by her daughters, she'd crossed the Atlantic on the Titanic's sister ship, the Olympic.
She was in her suite, and Marie Mattingly Maloney, Missy, warned her that she was going to have to meet some reporters and that there were photographers. And she took a little while, and she finally came out, and she was interviewed by a battery of reporters. This is where she supposedly said that radium could cure all diseases, even the very deep tumors.
Marie Curie's name was increasingly being linked to a radical cancer treatment that she and Pierre had developed. For cancers that were readily accessible, say on the face, tiny flecks of radium would be carefully positioned over the tumor. The radiation would kill the cancer cells. And if the patient was lucky, their healthy cells would in time repair the lesion.
Photos of treated patients.
Marie herself had little to do with cancer treatment. Her focus remained purely on radioactivity research. But Missy was a master of spin. She knew that selling a dedicated scientist to the American public would be tough.
She needs to make her look likable, but that also means making her look appropriate. She has to depict her not as a scientist at all, but as this maternal figure, who, of course, didn't actually discover radium because she was, you know, doing science for science's sake, like men do. She was doing it because, of course, she wanted to rid humanity of cancer, like any good mother would want to, and this is really why she discovered radium. And so this is the publicity that Curie walks into when she comes to New York in 1921.
Brownstone buildings viewed from a moving vehicle, then footage of Marie being feted in New York.
Marie began a series of public engagements that Missy had laid on that would last for 8 weeks.
The program seemed very intimidating. It was assumed that I would not only attend a ceremony at the White House, but also visit many universities and colleges in several towns. Some of these institutions had contributed to the fund. All desired to offer me honors.
The timing of her coming to the United States was not a coincidence. Women had just won suffrage in the United States in 1920. They're just starting to get the right to vote in this country. So she's thinking she's a very good role model for American women.
heading across a bridge towards the skyscrapers of New York.
Marie Curie began her US tour here, in the city of New York, and it was immediately clear that amongst American women, she had become a star.
A large, square, brownstone building.
We're here in Carnegie Hall, and I'm thinking back to May 18th, 1921, when Marie Curie was honored.
Rows and tiers of plush red seats in the auditorium.
We know that when Marie Curie entered, there were thunderous applause, and the applause took maybe about 5 minutes to die down. The event was sponsored by American University Women, and it was a celebration of Curie, but it was also a celebration of really higher education for women in the United States. According to newspaper accounts, there were supposedly 3,500 women in attendance. The colleges decorated the hall with their banners. It must have been very colorful, certainly very exciting.
A steam train belching black smoke.
Marie was an instant hit. And all the while as she toured the States, Missy worked hard to protect the legend she was creating.
Everybody was very good about not mentioning the scandal, the sex scandal in Paris. And of course, remember, this was Maloney making very clear, when you cover her, do not discuss this.
Exhausted, Marie finally arrived in Washington for her last appointment at the White House itself.
It was a deeply moving ceremony in all of its simplicity. It comprised a short presentation by the French ambassador, a speech by Missy Maloney on behalf of the American women, and then the address of President Harding.
A creased photo.
At last, she received what she'd come to America for.
When Harding hands her the ceremonial box of radium, he says this is a gift from the American people, and he even goes so far as to say, you know, we are just in awe of you, not only for your science, but because you did all this and still were the perfect wife and mother.
Footage of Marie leaning on a railing.
Marie returned to France with her name restored and the future of her beloved institute secure.
Marie climbing into a hansom cab.
She would return again to America to collect more radium for a second radium institute in Warsaw she was helping to establish. But it would take an even greater toll on her failing health.
Footage of the pioneer working in her laboratory.
Soon after she came home, she wrote to Missy.
My very dear friend, your letter distressed me. I did not know that you had a bad accident. I too had troubles, a kind of general disease which obliged me to take a very strict diet, probably to last for the future.
After years of ill health, her family helped nurse Marie during her final months.
Eve really comes to terms with her mother later in life. She's the one that really cares for her in her final days. And I think that there's sort of a reconciliation. But it was a very, the relationship between them was torn for some time. It took her mother dying, I think, and her being there to take care of her for them to sort of reconcile.
The actress who's read Marie's letters bears a solemn expression.
On the 4th of July, 1934, Marie Curie died, aged 67, with Eve by her side.
There's a halo of hazy light around her head as the actress turns and walks away. A small cemetery.
Her doctor gave the cause of death as aplastic pernicious anemia. Her bone marrow had been injured by the long accumulation of radiation, so it seemed her child, radium, had killed her. She was buried in this cemetery, just outside Paris, where she shared a grave with Pierre.
A grey-haired man walks amongst the headstones.
And here they lay together for over 60 years. Until one spring day in 1995, when radio protection expert Jean-Luc Pasquier came to examine her remains.
Once
the tomb was opened, we wanted to check that the radiation was not stronger in the depths.
Ou peu supérieur à celui qu'on trouvait ici.
Since the half-life of radium is 1600 years, they were worried that Marie was still radioactive because they were about to move her body.
Our measurements showed that the radiation levels were very low, barely above what we'd find in any Parisian cellar.
En région parisienne.
We also did some smears by rubbing the forehead and pelvis of Marie Curie with blotting paper.
Sorte de papier buvard, on a frotté le front et le bassin de Marie Curie.
Lab analysis showed very little radiation contamination to Marie Curie.
Elle était très peu contaminée au radium.
This surprised everyone, because if the myth was correct and radium exposure had made her a martyr to her science, her remains should still exceed today's safe levels. So it led the team to speculate that something else had caused her premature demise.
Probablement Marie Curie, et même très certainement Marie Curie.
Marie Curie probably died because she was exposed to radiation, but that radiation was not radium.
Probablement aussi, les rayonnements en question sont pas issus du radium. Donc en fait, elle est morte d'une maladie radioactive.
She died from a radio-induced disease, probably from exposure during the war when she was working with X-rays.
Pendant la guerre de 14 sur le front en radioscopie médicale.
If X-rays killed Marie, then she was a different kind of martyr. Her life ended prematurely, like so many others, as the result of her efforts in the Great War.
The imposing domed presence of Paris's Pantheon.
A few days later, here in the heart of Paris, the Curies were given a full state funeral.
Adieu. The building's portico of Corinthian columns.
This square and the street down there are absolutely packed with people. And there's a big white carpet coming all the way up the street, across the square, and up the steps into the Pantheon.
Footage of the procession.
They'd made it into France's national mausoleum.
An overhead view of the two coffins being carried inside.
In a sense, it was a final journey for Pierre and Marie Curie, but for Marie Curie in particular, it was a very momentous occasion because she was the first woman to be buried in the Pantheon as a tribute to her own individual achievements.
At last, France had made it up to Marie Curie, this brave, brilliant Polish scientist, so cruelly shamed in life, had received her adopted country's highest honor.
Archive footage of an elderly Marie Curie smiling.
Autrefois tu respirais le soleil d'or, tu marchais sur des trésors. On était vagabonds, on aimait les chansons. Ça finit dans la prison.